the Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we conclude our series on three of the most famous or infamous of ancient Romans, Livia, Agrippina, and Caligula, by taking a look at the most infamous of all, the Emperor Caligula. Talking History's Eileen Dugan takes up the subject with her guest, Anthony Barrett, the author of Caligula, The Corruption of Power. And after that, Edward Lenenthal looks at how the Holocaust has evolved in the American consciousness since the end of World War II. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on November 5, 1844, James K. Polk defeated Whig candidate Henry Clay to become the 11th President of the United States. Although he was no newcomer to politics, Polk was little known when he first entered the 1844 presidential campaign. He'd served in the House of Representatives from 1825 through 1839, and he was governor of Tennessee from 1839 to 1841, but he was not the Democrats' first choice. He was nominated on the ninth ballot of the Democratic National Convention after the favorite, Martin Van Buren, opposed annexing Texas, a position that cost him Southern support. In his acceptance of the nomination, Polk wrote, "It has been well observed that the office of President of the United States should neither be sought nor declined. I have never sought it, nor should I feel at liberty to decline it, if conferred upon me by the voluntary suffrages of my fellow citizens." Polk's obscurity drew derision from the Whig opposition, but he won the election and went on to keep his campaign promises to reach agreement with Britain over the disputed Oregon Territory, gaining today's states of Oregon and Washington, and annexing Texas. And he remained true to his word in not seeking re-election, leaving the White House after only one term in office.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a final report on Peru's brutal 20-year war against the Shining Path insurgency has concluded that nearly 70,000 people were killed and incriminates more than 100 government and army officers by name in those deaths. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission's 9-volume report says that the conflict was exacerbated by deep racism and a fundamental misunderstanding of the Highland Indians, who constituted most of the victims. The violence erupted in May 1980 when the Shining Path, the Maoist-inspired rebel movement, began terrorizing peasants to force them into supporting its drive to overthrow the Peruvian government. The army was unfamiliar with the Shining Path's strategy and suspicious that many Highland Indians supported the guerrillas. It responded with a brutal campaign against the Indian communities. And a manuscript given to the Library of Congress may solve the mystery of just how the British caught Nathan Hale. It turns out that the famous revolutionary American spy made a monumentally naive mistake. He told the British agent of his plans. According to the manuscript, written during or soon after the American Revolution by Connecticut Tory Consider Tiffany, Major Robert Rogers, a British Army officer, pretended to be a colonial spy himself, thereby getting Hale to confide in him. One night, while the two dined behind enemy lines in New York, Hale was arrested. He was convicted of spying and executed on September 22, 1776, reportedly uttering the now famous line, "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country." This is Talking History.
Thank you.
known as a cold-blooded murderer who engaged in incest, tried to make his favorite horse consul, and may have been insane. At least that's the popular view of the Roman Emperor Caligula. Eileen Dugan looks for the truth in these and other allegations in her third and final conversation in this series with Anthony Barrett.
The Roman Emperor Caligula ranks among the most familiar names in ancient history, but that is certainly not due to any good deeds that he might have done. Rather, Caligula derives his immortality from the ancients' tales of cold-blooded murder, incest, and insanity. After all, someone who allegedly tried to make his favorite horse a consul can't be quite right in the head, can he? But has history been entirely fair in its treatment of Caligula? Is it possible to re-examine the sources and derive, if not a totally positive image of Caligula, at least a more balanced, less propaganda-driven interpretation? With us today to explore the reign and character of this most notorious, infamous emperor of Rome is Dr. Anthony A. Barrett, professor of classics at the University of British Columbia. Professor Barrett is the author of Caligula, The Corruption of Power. Welcome, Dr. Barrett.
Hello.
What was Caligula's lineage, and how did he come to be known as Caligula?
Caligula reigned in a period that we call the Julio-Claudian period, and that means that it was the first dynasty of Rome and came from two powerful Roman families, the Julians and the Claudians. The first Roman emperor, Augustus, was a Julian by his adoption by his great-uncle, Julius Caesar. His wife, Livia, was a Claudian. Augustus and Livia didn't have children together, but they had children by previous marriages. And the later emperors came from the union of these two lines. So Caligula was the great-grandson of Augustus and the great-grandson of Livia. He was the son of a man called Germanicus. Again, this was Livia's grandson, an immensely popular figure, a fine soldier, a disarming manner. He had what we would now call charisma. And he, usefully, I suppose, for his political image, he died young. So Germanicus died with his charisma intact, and Caligula was able to inherit this public image of his father. So he came then from a very strong line, both a Julian and a Claudian, and with a very, very popular, charismatic father.
And how did he get his nickname?
Germanicus was married to Agrippina the Older. You have to distinguish her from the later Agrippina, the mother of Nero. This is Agrippina the Older, who was the granddaughter of Augustus. Agrippina the Older was a very ambitious woman, very proud of her connection with Augustus, and she was very determined that one of her sons would eventually succeed as emperor. So she, from a very early stage, went out of her way to enhance their image. And when he was very small, Caligula joined his father on military campaign. And Agrippina was with her husband, with Germanicus, and she dressed the infant Caligula up in a soldier's uniform. And Caligula means little boots. So these were the sort of small soldier's boots, a miniature pair of soldier's boots. And this apparently was the nickname that the soldiers gave him. And they loved him. Her scheme worked because it made him immensely popular as the sort of soldier's mascot.
Would this popularity derived from his father be important throughout his life?
It was immensely important. It was the key to his succession. And not only that, even later emperors would claim this link. Claudius was the brother of Germanicus and owed his succession to a large extent to that. The later emperor Nero was descended from Germanicus and would great-great-great-great-great-grandson and would lay claim to that descent from Germanicus. It was a remarkable phenomenon, and I think it ties in very much with the Roman concept of the family, that whatever qualities your family has, they will be passed down from generation to generation. So it was just assumed that Caligula automatically would have all of the fine diplomatic and liberal qualities of his father.
What do we know about Caligula's life and character before his accession in AD 37? I mean, was he the wild youth that we've come to imagine?
We know very, very little of his earlier life, and he almost certainly wasn't a wild youth. We know little, the Romans seem to have known little, but certainly when he came to power, he didn't have a reputation for wildness. The Romans greeted his accession with jubilation, and they thought that he was going to be someone who would bring in a new golden age. So if he had been a wild and irresponsible youth, I'm sure that they would have thought differently. He spent many years before his accession on the island of Capri with his aged uncle Tiberius, and whatever we may hear of Tiberius and the stories of Tiberius and Capri, when we look at the names of the people who were on Capri at the time, they're all philosophers and scholars and politicians, and I rather think that Caligula would have led a fairly dull life there.
Well, once he became emperor in AD 37, you note that the first 6 months pretty well went without any major incidents, but then he became ill. And what were the first signs that something was starting to go wrong with the emperor?
Right, well, you're quite right. For the first 6 months, there was an almost constant euphoria. There was a tremendous building program. He did what politicians have done ever since. He bought his popularity. He spent lavishly. And all the hopes of the Romans seemed to be likely to be fulfilled. And then he fell seriously ill, and he was ill for perhaps a month. And when he recovered, it was clear that we were into a new phase. Things were different. We have the first executions, first signs of tension between Caligula and the Senate. And it's very difficult to work out exactly what had happened. There has always been a theory that Caligula's illness was kind of affected his mental balance, that perhaps it was some virus that affected his brain. I don't believe this, because when we look at his actions after his illness, they're still very, very rational. And in fact, he doesn't become extremely erratic for about 2 years after the illness. And I speculate that perhaps what happened was that he had spent the first 6 months as the most important person in the Roman world. He was a young man without any political experience worth speaking of. He'd suddenly been catapulted to being the most powerful person in the world. People flattered him, they sought his counsel, they curried favor, they acceded to every wish. But when he fell ill, although we're not given any details of this in the sources, we have to assume that the daily life of Rome had to continue, so the government would have to go on as normal, and his adopted son, Gemellus, would probably have had to assume authority. And I suspect that Caligula found this difficult to cope with when he recovered. He suddenly discovered that the world could go on very well without him. Not only that, but that other people had assumed power and influence and perhaps looked in a position to threaten him. And I think that's what might have caused the change in his attitude.
I guess one question that needs to be asked at this point is just how old was Caligula when he came to the throne?
He was 25.
Okay. Well, how well did Caligula fulfill the duties of the emperor, the standard duties, his relationship with the Senate, military campaigns, building projects?
It's very difficult to get a proper assessment of Caligula, and that's because our main source for the Julio-Claudian period is Tacitus, and the chapters of Tacitus on Livia are missing completely. Now, Tacitus was a person who had his strong biases, but he was nevertheless in many ways a reliable historian. He did his research. So we don't have Tacitus's account, and we have to rely on people like Suetonius, who display very little critical judgment in the way they handle the material they got. So they, Suetonius recounts frivolous tales of Caligula's, really quite outrageous sometimes, and it's very, very difficult for us without Tacitus as a balance to work out how reliable they are. If I could take an example, you mentioned the military. We have these wonderful stories in Suetonius of how Caligula decided that he would conquer Britain, and he first went to Germany, and he would lead his troops over the German frontier and then run back in panic and do this over and over again. And then finally he got to the British shore, and he told his soldiers to go fight with the ocean and collect shells as booty. Well, when you hear that, you think this is a man who's totally incompetent and irresponsible. However, if we think very carefully about this campaign, I'm just taking this as an example, I'm sure that he did have a plan to conquer Britain. All Roman emperors did until it was finally conquered. To do this, he first of all had to secure the Rhine frontier, because otherwise German tribes could cross over it, cut him off from supplies in Britain. And to do this, he didn't want to wage a full-scale war with Germany. He would lead small raids into Germany just to show the Roman strength on the Rhine frontier. So I think that is rational. We know that when he got to the British coastline, the German frontier still wasn't secured, and I think at that stage he decided not to launch an invasion. Fortunately for him, at that point, a British prince surrendered, broke away from his anti-Roman father, crossed the Channel, and surrendered to Caligula. And Caligula, I think, saw this as an opportunity to tell Rome that he had achieved this great victory in Britain without having to shed any blood at all. So he told his soldiers to collect the shells from the ocean as the plunder of the ocean. They symbolized the conquest of ocean, because the conquest of Britain was in very many ways the conquest of the final ocean that enveloped the world. So seen in that light, Caligula's military campaign was fairly rational. I think in dealing with the Senate, we have the picture of Caligula, who was very suspicious of the senators. He put a lot of the senators to death because they were plotting against him. But of course, I think they probably were plotting against him. Well, we know that there was a plot at the end, certainly. The senators had adopted Caligula as emperor, thinking that he was a young man, a personable young man whom they could control. And then they discovered that they couldn't control him, and plots were formed to get rid of him. So Caligula did what rulers have done throughout history. He responded by getting rid of his senatorial opponents. So I think in its totality that Caligula's behavior was not one that was particularly competent, but I think still rational.
Well, in your final chapter, you suggest that if indeed Caligula was mad, and that,
yes,
that does seem to be open to question, that Caligula wasn't so much a what you call potty eccentric, like Ludwig of Bavaria, but more of a Stalinesque figure.
Well, yes.
Why do you make that comparison?
Right. Well, first of all, in the Ludwig of Bavaria contrast, I think Caligula's behavior was often outrageous, but it wasn't the outrageous behavior of a madman. For instance, we're told by the sources that he was planning to make his horse consul. Now, this might seem a slightly crazy thing to want to do. If we put it in the Roman context, it's not quite so serious. But first of all, he didn't make his horse consul. He said that he was planning to make his horse consul. There's a world of difference there. The Roman emperor had the power to designate who would become the next consul. What I envisage here is that the senators approached Caligula, said, which of us have you chosen to be the next consul? So Caligula's response is, well, when I look at you, I see a pathetic bunch of candidates. I think my horse could do the job better than any of you. So, you know, I think we can see a rational explanation there. We're told that Caligula had conversations with the moon. When we look at the particular context of that, we find that it's an episode where a Roman figure, Roman politician, who was constantly anxious to win imperial favor, was brought into Caligula's presence, and Caligula, I think, was sort of pulling his leg and said, do you see the moon in my presence? Because this would put the man in a difficult spot. If he says yes, it makes him seem a complete fool. If he says no, he would be afraid that he would offend Caligula. So I think Caligula was playing games with him, and this man, Vitellius, rose to the occasion. He said, sire, only gods can see other gods. So he ducked out of it nicely. So I think when we look at these episodes that are supposed to indicate madness, they really don't hold up. So I think that unlike, say, Ludwig of Bavaria, Caligula understood his own actions. He knew what he was doing. He could distinguish between right and wrong and the like. But he seemed to have had no sort of moral sense in that he would quite willingly put people to death without turning a hair simply to secure his own power. And I think Stalin is the perfect example of that. Stalin, who was responsible for the death of millions, but wasn't mad in the sense that Stalin's actions were always cool and rational, always designed to propping up his own power, and yet he seems to have had no moral compunction about sending people off to their death.
All right, well, thank you very much, Dr. Barrett.
Thank you.
Hey, we have been talking with Dr. Anthony A. Barrett, professor of classics at the University of British Columbia and author of Caligula, The Corruption of Power.
Welcome back. For our site of the week, we point you to a place on the net where you can learn more about the history of the American Indians of the Pacific Northwest. Here to tell you about the site is Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
Read highly political late 19th century annual reports from the Commissioner of Indian Affairs to the Secretary of the Interior about American Indians in the Pacific Northwest. Examine rock art photographed in the early 20th century. Look at studio and candid photographs of American Indians, from children to elders. Learn about the customs and everyday lives of American Indians in the Northwest Coast and Plateau regions of the Pacific Northwest in the late 19th and early 20th centuries through this digital archive of more than 2,000 photographs and 7,000 pages of text. The materials illustrate housing, clothing, crafts, transportation, education, employment, and other aspects of everyday life of American Indians from Oregon to Alaska during a period of change and adaptation to U.S. government restrictions. Items drawn from museum collections in Washington State are accompanied by information on the source, medium, and other descriptive notes of interest. The site offers 10 essays by anthropologists on specific tribal groups, and cross-cultural topics help explain the sources in the collection and possible ways to make sense of them. The site is searchable by keyword and may be browsed by subject, geographic location, and author or photographer. It is ideal for exploring the lives of American Indians in the Pacific Northwest. To locate this website, go to historymatters.gmu.edu and type Pacific Northwest into the keyword search.
And finally, the Holocaust may have been the most horrific event of the 20th century, leaving an indelible mark on our memories, public and private. But just what should that memory be, and how should it be represented? Edward Lindenthal, a professor of religious studies at the University of Wisconsin at Oshkosh, offers us his thoughts on those and other related questions in our commentary of the week.
On April 22, 1993, the Holocaust was officially incorporated into American memory with the dedication of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Standing on the Washington Mall with thousands of others on that raw, rainy morning, I was already immersed in writing about the making of this celebrated museum. Was the Holocaust a memory that should be an official American memory, or was it out of place, better recalled in Europe or Israel? What physical shape should this memory take? Would a monument do, or a museum of comparative genocide? And, once it was decided that this institution would be an activist memorial environment composed of memorial space, museum exhibition space, educational space, library and archival space, where should it be located? In New York City, perhaps, or in the nation's capital? Certainly the location of the museum, adjacent to America's Memorial Center, the Washington Mall, declared the Holocaust a central American memory. But how, in fact, is Holocaust memory mobilized? Is the declaration never again only a formulaic slogan? While President Clinton was dedicating the museum, his administration resisted characterizing as genocidal the slaughter in the Balkans, and it would also turn away from genocide in Rwanda. Sadly, too many administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, turned away before, during, and after the Holocaust in Armenia, in Europe, in Cambodia, in Bosnia, in Rwanda, in Iraq when Kurds were slaughtered. We wish the memory of such evil to be as transformative as the event itself. Perhaps this is too much to ask. I am skeptical that governments will ever effectively mobilize Holocaust memory. I do believe, however, that communities and individuals can work out of this memory by resisting racist violence, consequently making meaningful the phrase, never again, and through their actions offering a response to the question, can it ever stop? If people do not let the Holocaust Museum do their remembering for them, but work out of these volatile memories in their own lives, the museum can indeed be a living memorial.
You've been listening to Edward Lindenthal, professor of religious studies at the University of Wisconsin at Oshkosh, and the author of Preserving Memory, The Struggle to Create America's Holocaust Museum. And that wraps up another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments and suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beattie, assistant producer. If you'd like to learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians, visit our website at oah.org. Our site of the week was produced by Amanda Schumann of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.